The following episode contains words that my mom and dad use when they think I'm not around. I use them anyway, but you might not want your kids to hear them. You've been warned.
Coming to you from the Sherpa Chalet at the top of beautiful downtown Mount Podcastia, it's a special episode of Too Many Podcasts. I'm Jim the Podcast Sherpa, and today it's a special episode where I get to speak with people from the entertainment industry. So get yourself an aisle seat, pop up some popcorn, and get a cold drink ready, and sit back. Don't crunch too loud or else you'll miss the interview from the Sherpa Screening Room. Hey there, Rebels. Welcome to the Sherpa Screening Room. It's me, Jim, the Podcast Sherpa, and you are listening to a bonus episode. That's right. And what a bonus it is. You know, I've probably told this story a couple of times, but I've always wanted to do a music podcast and get musicians on the show and interview them. But somehow that never really worked out. And believe me, there's a lot to do when you've got to do a music podcast as well. And then I got a call from my publicist supreme, Mr. Stephen Joyner, and said, I got a present for you. And who do I get to talk to? I get to talk to none other than Jesse Blaze Snyder. That's right. And he's got a new album out called Come With Me If You Want to Live. And we'll play a couple of tracks from there. And we had a really good time talking as well. So before we go on to the interview, you know what I'm going to say, that today's podcast is being brought to you by Audible, and you can get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at www.audibletrial.com/Sherpa. There's over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. All right, let's head on down and take a listen to my conversation with Jesse Blaze Snyder. Hello there, Rebels. We are here in the music room of the Sherpa Chalet, and I've got a very special guest with me today. He is a graphic novel creator, a voiceover actor, an actor, a TV host, a radio show host, a former MTV VJ, a producer, a music consultant, and a vocalist. And he just released an album earlier this year called Come With Me If You Want to Live. His name is Mr. Jesse Blaze Snyder. Jesse, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, brother. I kind of missed, you know, when a few, I did an interview a little while ago and one before, and they both went, Come With Me If You Want to Live. You know, I like almost forgot where it came from, but that's totally where it came from.
Of course, we're referring to the movie Little Women, of course.
Yes. You know, it was really funny to me. That title made me feel better about releasing something as a solo artist, because I've always been a band guy, and I've been trying to sort of like, was trying to force that when it wasn't really convenient over and over again, because I preferred it to being, you know, just Jesse Blaze. So it felt like somebody who's got their head up there. But when I thought of the title, Come With Me If You Want to Live, I was like, only an individual could say that. You know, like that like fits the solo artist. Come with me if you want to live. And as an artist who really is not here to just entertain you and make you smile, I want you to think, and I want to grow you and help you understand and process your pain and your joy and give you an outlet for all these emotions that we have. And, you know, that's really what it means. You know, it's not come with me if you don't want to die. It's come with me if you want to truly live, if you want to know how to get through all of the sorrow on this planet. And as somebody who suffered with anxiety and suffered with depression and, you know, chronic pain and a lot of different things that are really tanking so much of America right now, I feel like the message is in the music and a lot of people need to hear it. So hopefully, if anything I just said resonates with you, you'll check out the record, because I wrote it for you guys.
Sure. And we are going to be playing a couple of tracks in the show, so everybody will get to hear that. So we will kind of jump back and forth to discussing the three tracks that we'll be featuring, if that's okay.
Absolutely. Sounds good.
And now your original music beginnings, they were in a band called Blazed.
I've told this story on TV before, if anybody's heard me speak in a few times, but my dad didn't really encourage me in particular with music. He felt like I had a lot of passions, but music wasn't necessarily as pronounced as the others. And one day when I went to go ask him like why he wasn't pushing me more, he told me I didn't have any passion. And I got really pissed at him. You know, he didn't exactly mean that, but that's what he said in the moment, and I reacted to it. And that set me on a sojourn to prove to him that, one, I could do it without him, and two, I had passion for music. I hooked up with my best friend, Chris Deline. I mean, I didn't know him, but he was a pupil of Bobby Rondinelli, and he and I became fast friends, and he really believed in me, made me believe in myself. And just as we were reaching like this pinnacle of starting to get some recognition, I was a VJ on MTV, all these things, he died in a car accident on our way home from a gig after dropping me off. And it really just like crushed me and my whole music experience. And I didn't really know what to do after that because I felt very dishonorable to go on without him because we had made so many plans together. Like this was what we were going to do, you know, as brothers, we're going to go be rock stars. And the idea that I was going to be a rock star and he was going to be dead, it was just like, that's not right. That's not fair. I can't be a rock star while he's dead. It's crazy, you know, all these things eventually led me on a very interesting spiritual journey. You know, I feel closer to Chris now than I ever did. You know, getting on that path was sort of the journey of my music. And you can hear a lot of that. You know, the first album that you can find is an anniversary for Baptized by Fire, which has some Blazed stuff on it. And it's real angry, raucous, punk, hard rock, metal. I was trying to be an American Motorhead. I love Motorhead. You know, that was like all that angst, you know, coming out and frustration. And then I wrote a lot of pop songs and songs for behind the scenes for films and stuff, which were on a lot of different albums. And that was just like all of my recognizing how I was loving everything too hard and I was hurting myself. And, you know, finally coming around to the spiritual journey, I kind of started it on the Blacklight District EP, which I did as a comic book, and I ended up writing a lot about my soul journey and depression and anxiety. And then this album, when I started just sort of angling towards it, I'd written a song called Promised Land, which was just really kind of spontaneous. We wrote it in like 6 hours, like it was done in 6 hours, like just fully produced and everything. And then it was on ESPN Monday Night Football in like a month. And I didn't have any videos. I didn't have anything, nothing to capitalize on it. People couldn't download it. I was doing behind the scenes music. I wasn't like an out in the open artist, but it was a hit song on Monday Night Football next to AC/DC and Papa Roach. It was really cool. And that started to get my wheels going because it was about my personal journey looking for heaven on earth, trying to find peace. And, you know, peace of mind, really. I was just like, my mind was just so dangerous. I could just destroy myself so easily. You know, all the different things that I had to learn to get through that and through that process became the sort of pillars of this record. And, you know, it's very much a, this is how I did it. Maybe you could survive the same way kind of thing. And also my opening salvo to everybody that I was here to help, that that I was making music designed to bring peace and give an outlet for frustration and an outlet for joy. And, you know, the album was originally going to be called Help Is Coming because I've got this great song that I really love called Help Is Coming, which is like a kind of blues country song that tells a story about this young girl being given a rifle and told to hold the door and don't let anybody in and I'm leaving, but help is coming. You know, you just hold the fort and you know, but the song never resolves. You never know if the help is coming. It just ends with this, in my mind, this father screaming, help is coming. Like he's just on his horse riding as fast as he can to get there to save his little girl. And, you know, we all feel like we need help and we're waiting on the help to arrive. And that was my message to everybody, that help is coming. But as I recognized that, I was like, no, help isn't coming. It's in here. I'm here. And that was when I said, no, like I was thinking the next album might be called Come With Me If You Want to Live. And I was like, no, it's this album. That's the message. come with me if you want to live. At the end of Help is Coming, in my mind, the Father arrives and everything's okay. You know, help is here. And we end with a song called Bandolier, which is kind of my, like, my friend base, as I like to call them, battle cry of, you know, going out to the world and trying to do good and being tough and making the world a better place, one good deed at a time.
You're releasing a video for the song KO. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, we just shot it. It's just like a pretty simple but cool thing, you know, on all white screens so we can white out the background. I've got a couple really good friends playing, you know, performing for the video, and we're just cutting together a pretty cool in-your-face bit. I really tried to embody the rat in the cage as much as I could. I'm shirtless with a little bandana around. I got tattoos all over my body. So the idea behind KO was that, you know, it's one thing for a KO as like, it's a nice thing to get in a fight. Wouldn't it be nice to knock the guy out? Sure. But there are moments in fights where you've been losing for so much of the fight that the only way for you to win at that point is to knock them out. If you cannot knock them out in the next 2.5 minutes or, you know, whatever it may be, that's it. This is over. You've come all this way. You've worked all of this hard for nothing. And that is what KO is about. It's, you know, about knowing that you cannot win by decision. You have to get the victory that leaves no question in anybody's mind who the winner is. So there's definitely a lot of skinny man ready to just chew his way through the bones if he has to in the song. And I really channeled that as a starving artist in so many regards, you know, starving in the ways of my heart. It's a good one. It was really cool. I tried to embody Linkin Park, and it was one of my first songs where I let myself rap, which I've been writing raps and rapping for years. I love rap. Rage Against the Machine is one of my favorite songs. But I just like, there was like this like line where I was like, I don't know, it was like cultural appropriation or some bullshit. But I just felt like I really had something to offer, because as a voiceover actor and a spoken word, you know, it's a mix of things. And I'm somebody who is articulate and also really dynamic in what I can do with my voice. And I like to be kind of theatrical, and being able to sing and speak and cross those things over, it's just all more, you know, ingredients for a delicious stew, I think.
Sure. Why don't we check out KO right now?
Cool. Come on.
Lying just so he could eat. Been hungry for so long, but when I hear my song, I know this ring is the only place I belong. I'm in the beginning of killing for a living. I'm breaking the hearts of innocent women. I'm tired of losing, won't get tired of winning. It's not tomorrow, no sorrow, I'm grinning.
storm. Horror came without warning. While your vision is blurring, keep worrying worse than before.
Just wait till that bell rings.
And that's KO from Come With Me. And you know what? Wait a minute. You're the radio guy. You were actually on the Bone 98. You want to do your radio watch?
Oh, you're listening to 98.5 The Bone. So how are you doing? That was Jesse Blaze, KO from Come With Me If You Want to Live, his debut solo album, Kicking Ass. And naming names or taking names. See, I messed it up at the end. I got too cocky.
Hey, you did a better job than me. So I was like, blah, 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 blah.
You called your show Raul at the beginning of the show. You were like, hello, Raul. Who's Raul?
He probably works at the chalet somewhere.
Do you have an engineer in that room named Raul? That's a good ongoing joke. Whenever you need to, like, turn off to your producer. What do you think, Raul? Okay.
Well, I've got the lawyer named Dirty Louie already, so Raul, we can add to the cast of characters.
Nice, yes.
And now you have another song on the album called Bartender?
You know, it's funny. I wrote this song a long time ago, although it has taken on a lot of meaning for me. I wrote it when I was in Nashville, hanging out with some of John Rich's camp from, you know, Big and Rich. His buddy Charlie, who's one of his business guys, I love him, my big brother, and I was working with some of his people, and I was hanging out with this dude Gabe, who I was writing another song with, and we went down to this bar, and I guess this was something that he did relatively regularly. We went into this bar to kind of check in with this girl that he was trying to make some time with. And she was just like kind of the obvious pinnacle of like what everybody wanted. And it's funny because I tend not to go for, I don't know, like girls who are too concerned about visual aesthetic and things like that. And I kind of prefer curvy girls or whatever else. So I was having a nice conversation with this curvy bartender at the end of the bar, who I thought was really cute and very sweet. And seeing as she wasn't getting any attention when this other bitch was around, who my friend was literally like coming in every day to say hello to. And I just got this idea for the unattainable bartender, you know, that I'm like, this is just a universal thing all around the world at every bar. Who's the girl that the lovesick puppies are coming in to try to make some time with? And this is how this lady is making a living. And, you know, and most likely she's probably got an actual dude at home waiting for her, because somebody's, look at how many options she has, you know. And I just started writing this fun thing about, you know, you're not going to go home with the bartender because she's going home with me, which was really just me being part of the argument. It's like, no, she's mine. You know, so it's like, even I'm the idiot who thinks I'm going to make time with the bartender. And this big argument and conversation. But it was amazing to me because I ended up really falling in love pretty hard after my marriage with this girl, Megan Amato, who I adore. And her and I aren't together right now because we weren't really good for each other at the moment. And I think, you know, we had to be wise enough to respect that. Maybe one day we will get together. I would like us to, because I like her a lot. I had the experience that I had written about, and she was the bartender of my dreams. And when I first met her, I was still married, and I was literally hiding because I didn't like want to like her any more than I already did. I was just like, oh my God, this girl. She just vacuumed me. And I used to sneak downstairs to the top bar to check her out. And as I was coming with this in my spiritual journey, that was, you know, she was like the love of my life, you know, really like what I desired. And, you know, that's why I hope that, you know, one day we'll come together when the time's right. I think we both have some growing to do, and wasn't the right time, which sometimes is the case, but I'm a patient man. You know, and it really became this great song that had so much more meaning to me now, because I was just kind of writing it like as a joke. And then all of a sudden it became my song about the girl I really liked, you know, sort of me reclaiming my desires and knowing what I wanted. And a song that I was trying to give to some country artist became a song that just made super good sense for me to record. And I loved it, and I loved singing it, and it's just a fun, funny song. It has some of the funniest moments of any song that I've ever written. There's this great breakdown at the end where I'm in the audience, and I'm just sort of like, we recorded me a couple dozen times heckling me. And if you listen closely, my heckling is awesome. I heckle the shit out of myself. It's really, really great self-deprecating, where I'm just like talking on stage and I'm making fun of me in so many different ways. It was just a wonderful moment of fun in the studio to record. And hopefully it comes across in the song, because I really loved it when I wrote it, loved recording it, and then loved when I had my own story of the bartender who I wanted so badly, and having that there. It's come to mean a lot to me, a very joyful song.
You know what, I'll do the DJ intro to this one. We'd like to send this one out to that special curvy lady behind the bar. This one's called Bartender by Jesse Blaze Snyder.
Bartender in this
growing up, Jesse, what were your musical influences? I mean, there's a lot of different sounds and styles in the songs that you've done over the years, even in the EPs and the albums.
Yeah, you know, I ended up basically being a child of the 70s for two reasons. I was introduced to the most commercial of 70s music and even good 60s music and stuff by my love for The Muppet Show. My mom was a big fan of The Muppet Show, and we used to watch that a lot. And there are great, great, great 70s artists being represented across the board, disco and rock artists. I mean, really, and everything in between, great country. And that gave me a smorgasbord's worth of wonderful little influences there. And also the way that those things are delivered, it makes all of the different genres so charming in their own way, you know, all these different sketches that the Muppets put on. So I was very charmed by the different things that different styles of music could do. And also, I think, very charged by the spiritual intellect that was going into most 70s music, because so many of these artists were partaking in psychedelic drugs and connecting to a oneness that kind of comes from working with plant medicine, working with like psilocybin or ayahuasca, which me and so much of my family has now partaken in a lot. You know, you realize it's sort of a oneness of the planet, a oneness of spirit, and a real universal consciousness of emotion. And there are some really amazing emotional things that have come out of that. And then my father, he is a metalhead through and through, but his influences are all from the 70s, largely. You know, he's not like, check out Motley Crue, son. You know, that wasn't anything that ever happened. You know, his peers weren't people who he was sharing with me so much as his influences. So AC/DC, Motorhead, the Ramones, the New York Dolls, and UFO, and, you know, T-Rex, and, you know, so many, Led Zeppelin, and Black Sabbath, and Iron Maiden, and all bands like that. So those were my real root influences. Lots of great 70s music, really heavy stuff, and then really melodic stuff and bluesy, soulful stuff from The Muppet Show. And then as I got older, I came up in the, you know, like the grunge era, which had a real mix of things. I wasn't a super big grunge guy because I felt like that was like the Starbucks of rock and roll for a while, as far as I was concerned. Even though I liked Alice in Chains and I liked Soundgarden and certain things, I was never a huge fan of Nirvana. I didn't really get them. I just didn't get their lyrics, really. I didn't understand what he was trying to say. Or it didn't align with me what he was trying to say. But people like Chris Cornell and Lane Stanley, like, you know, they really got me. You know, I really loved Dirt. But really, I was always, from that era, Rage Against the Machine is my favorite band of all time. So like Rage Against the Machine, a few bands that I would lump into, you know, that category, like maybe a Faith No More, you know, really rhythmic and rocking bands, even like harder bands like Propane, that just had a lot of rhythm and aggression and anger and were using rap as a tool of rock and roll. I really enjoyed those bands. And then I loved the cycling industrial stuff, you know, your Marilyn Manson and Nine Inch Nails and Rob Zombie and other bands like that, or like Power Man 5000. Really enjoyed that stuff. Always wanted to have an industrial band. I just never got around to doing it. Although Blacklight District stuff is kind of industrial, it's just a little bit more poppy. And then the other side of my other, like, you know, kind of favorite thing was punk. I love punk, especially lots of the political punk bands. You know, pop punk and, you know, Rancid. I love Tim Armstrong and Green Day, and The Offspring was one of my favorite bands of all time. Really enjoyed most of the punks I found to be very intellectual, and I was an intellectual, and I thought that they were saying great things. You know, like The Offspring, they were always big on sort of like making us look bad, you know, singing about society as it was, kind of. And it looked like they were the assholes, but they were like, no, we're just mimicking you, you know, bad habit. Let's get out of our car and blow someone away because of a traffic, you know, thing, you know, or you got to keep them separated. Oh no, it's all going to get bad because they're different and they're getting pissed off at each other. You know, they were just really showing us the stupidity that we were living. And I love, you know, that sort of intellectual play. It's why I love Marilyn Manson, why I really appreciated Rage Against the Machine. And of course, Dee Snider himself, Twisted Sister. And Desperado, his band after that, Widowmaker, little side projects that he's done. I think my father's brilliant, very, very underrated. And he's just a great lyricist, very empowering, and he puts just so much passion into what he does. I think it's infectious, especially if you've ever got to see him live. He's an incredible performer. So that basically sums it up.
I think I had mentioned to you earlier, I actually did see Twisted Sister before they hit it big, actually. There was a there was a bar on Long Island called Hammerheads. Yeah. And I think it was the law on Long Island at that point that if you didn't see either Twisted Sister or a band called Zebra at Hammerheads, then you weren't a true guy in that era.
I know them well. I mean, those are Hammerheads is, you know, the club that Twisted Sister built.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they were making clubs bigger because the audience for these local bands, Twisted Sister, Zebra, and a band called Rat Race Choir, were so big that they could make more money. So they were like, screw this, we're getting a bigger building so we can get bigger crowds. Twisted Sister was a Long Island phenomenon for ages, packing, you know, thousands of people, thousands, every night. That was just what you did. You know what I mean? We'll go out and see one of the bands. You know, like, they were playing every night of the week somewhere. You could go down if you wanted to get music. And you could get in, sneak in if you were 16, get in if you were 18. There was no computer games and distracting shit to divert you from a good time with some music. So, I mean, talk about an era. I wish I was around for it and hadn't just heard all the stories a million times.
Do you think that growing up on Long Island also inspired you because there were so many different types of musical styles that came out of Long Island?
Maybe. A little. I mean, Billy Joel lived pretty close to where my family lived a little while in Huntington. And that always made me feel like I had a little bit of a connection to him. And his stuff was a lot more up the middle and, you know, but still was rocking. Mm-hmm. You know, light rocking, but rocking. And occasionally very rocking. You know, like We Didn't Start the Fire. That's a fucking rocking song. You know, for me, it's all about how it feels, how it makes you feel. And, you know, a little bit. I don't know. You know what? Honestly, when you say that, I get to like a slight point of frustration because I'm like, being a band that having a band that had a unique style was a real problem for me because all the music by the time I was playing out in the area had been kind of divided up into little subgenres. It was like death metal night and punk night and you know, pop rock night and, you know, 80s night, and I would get lumped into 80s night because they didn't know what to do with me. Because I was a unique band that wasn't like super, super heavy. I was kind of commercial, but I was heavy. And it was, you know, it was a heavy experience on stage. But I didn't exactly fit with these guys and fit with, so they would put me with things that didn't really fit who I was because I was doing something new. And then I was constantly playing with like the Bullet Boys. And I'm just like, what am I doing here? These guys have given up on trying to speak to the masses in a language they can understand. I'm here with a new message. I have new things to say. Why am I with the old guys, you know, who are just reminding people of, you know, nostalgia?
Now, being an offspring of a heavy metal singer, as Jesse said, boy, his dad is Dee Snider of Twisted Sister, just in case you missed that, guys.
Yes, that is true.
Your dad didn't really have any expectations about you going into music. Do you think, like, critics did, that they figured you were going to sound like them or it was going to be a second coming of Twisted Sister? Because I noticed with your music, you really have your own style. You have your own sound. It's very separate from what your dad did. And that's really good. That probably made it a little bit easier, I guess.
Thank you. You know, I haven't really put myself out there on the limb as much as I should have. When I first started to, there was an immediate visceral reaction, which I would call sort of the Paris Hilton reaction, which was like, what, kid? You think we're just going to give this to you? You know, which I never did. I never thought that it would be given to me. I thought that if I was good enough that people would accept what I had to say. But it did kind of create a wall of expectation and for some people, like me needing to prove myself to them on some level. And it's funny, though, because I've been around so long now that I really don't ever hear that reaction anymore. You know, people aren't like, you haven't earned it, man. I mean, like, I've earned it. It's like, you know, I never needed to earn it. We don't need to earn it. You know, good things can just happen to good people. It doesn't have to be so difficult. But certainly if we're trying to make some sort of scale of like who's worked hard enough to achieve some success, I think I've done the things required. I think I've suffered enough, as it were, in plenty of ways. And I've made myself suffer because I really wanted to prove to myself that I deserve to be in the game. I deserve to be making music. And it was a long journey for me to finally go like, oh yeah, you're good enough. And I mean, I think when you started asking the question, I got to a certain answer, which is really most accurate. For me, my dad was Batman. And if you're a comic book fan and you understand what that means to be, that's Batman. You know, when you say that's Batman. Batman is the pinnacle of intelligence. He's the best there is at what the human mind and human body can do. That's what he represents. That's Batman. He's the pinnacle. And for me, my dad was the pinnacle. Like, look what you can do. I want to do this too. And I want to see if I can build upon the foundations that I've learned here. And as a comic book reader, reading the Batman comics, I really bonded with Dick Grayson. And I really bonded with Wally West, who was Kid Flash. And then he inherits the mantle of the Flash after Barry Allen dies. Because both of those characters were trying to honor this legacy that they held in such a high regard and did not want to diminish. You know, they wanted to add to it. They did not want to be a black mark on a stellar record. And that, for somebody who cares, and I care very deeply, that is the hardest, what was the hardest bit of it, was me just really caring so much about making sure I did a great job so that my dad would be proud and everybody would be like, we're glad he's here, and never question why I was there and if it was easy or whatever it might be.
And it's interesting, you know, we were talking about being the offspring of a rock star, and you were in the competition Rock the Cradle that was on MTV, and you came in second.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. I thought it was really interesting. I saw a clip where you wanted to do We're Not Going to Take It as a ballad. And yeah. And you're talking to your parents, and they're looking at you like, are you sure you want to do this, Jesse? And, you know, you went out there, and you started it off slow. And then, of course, you kicked the legs out from under it and really made it like a punk rock record, because it really is kind of a punk rock record, even more than a metal
record. Oh, total punk rock record, man. There's been some good punk rock covers. We got the right to choose it. There ain't no way we're losing. This is our life. This is our song. You see a little British accent. You're totally there.
Okay, mate. And it was funny because years later, your dad did the song as a ballad as well.
You know, I think it's actually ended up getting used in multiple capacities. I wanted to say it was for like cancer originally. He actually had a couple people come to him at the same time to, you know, with that idea to do that. And he was a little hesitant about it at first. But I was just like, yes, yes, yes. Allow people to hear your freaking words, man. Everybody got so distracted by Twisted Sister, bright, shiny colors, guys dressed as ladies. But the words, I Want to Rock. Everybody wants to freaking shortchange I Want to Rock. Make fun of that song. One, I Want to Rock contains a very simple emotion. I want to feel something. And the words to that, the verses, they are powerful and empowering. And, oh, I love some good Twisted Sister, man. One of my favorite bands of all time.
Apart from, like, I know you had the reality show growing up Twisted. What was your life like in that house, in your house, growing up when, like, the cameras weren't there? Did you feel like that you were just a regular kid and just... you and your siblings just did whatever, you know, kids would do at that time?
No. I think we all kind of felt like we were a pod being grown of superior people. not with sort of an eye on like, you guys suck and we're awesome, but an idea that we had been taught how to live as superior people, and that was important, and we were being trained to do that. And we were being sent out into the world as superior people to do superior things. And, you know, my parents really had their shit together and felt very good about their ideas for how to live. And I think we all felt very like they had the right answer and we got to live up to this. Granted, as we grew, we found the variants of the right answers, you know, for us individually. And, you know, most of us are, I think we're all, you know, pot smokers, and my parents have always been kind of against that because of their personal experiences. But for the children, our personal experiences has been that it's helped us manage our anxiety and get over our depression, helped us commune with spirits and become more spiritual, helped us meditate. For my brother, when he was on ADHD medicine, helped him eat, helped him sleep, so many things. So, you know, that's just sort of an example, but we definitely, I mean, I didn't smoke or drink until I was 28, coming from this solid thing of like, we've got the superior wisdom, take our wisdom, go into the world and be great. It was a lot of pressure. So we didn't necessarily, weren't raised to feel like we were like everybody else. We were trying to be better than everybody else because we saw how not trying to be any better was doing, you know? So our family was into making a real effort to be a platoon of great people. And they produced a platoon of great people. My brother Cody's an award-winning filmmaker, and he's going to be making a big-ass movie called Fool's Day with Margot Robbie soon, based on my brother Shane and his idea. And it's based on a short that they made that won a lot of awards. My brother Shane's a great writer and a comedian. My sister's a Instagram queen and designer, designing her own clothes on Instagram. And my mom's the most creative of the bunch. You know, she's just the best kept secret.
Maybe what it is your parents knew how to keep all of that fame and that talent in perspective. And that's probably what maybe aided all of you growing up as well.
Yeah, and the perspective was hard work, you know, that it was a journey to get to these things. And, you know, that really it was belief that got you there. And, you know, they did a study of the people who succeeded, and they found that the one commonality between them all was they never gave up. And, you know, and really that's what, you know, we learned most of all from my family. So, I mean, and honestly, largely, the reality show was a pretty good depiction of us. So much was condensed down. And there were a few things set up for the show, but they were set up because that's what we would normally do. So we were like, okay, we'll do this on Thursday. And that's kind of something that we like to do. And this is kind of something that we like to do. That's kind of, but I mean, really, it was very much based on what we do. And most of the things that people doubt about being real on the show were real. Most of the things that people believe were fake. Like there was a moment where I was brought to, hi, baby. I'm doing an interview right now. Oh, so cool. I hope I finish my interview while he's still here. Sorry, my kids just got home.
That's okay.
But, I love you too, buddy. We had set it up for this dude, Momo, who was in the band, to kind of chastise me, like, you know, what do I know? I'm just Dee Snider's kid kind of thing. And I have to, like, put him in his place and then we make up later. But Momo didn't really do that. He just agreed to go along with it. And it's funny because while that is something that like the internet might say, nobody has ever had the balls to say anything like that to my face. And I think it's because when they get in my face and they actually are experiencing me, they know that I'm a person of great depth and love for everybody and real consideration and empathy for the world. And that I'm certainly not anyone's enemy or anyone who deserves to be disrespected because I respect everybody. So I had never had that actually happen in my life other than assholes behind keyboards just sniping away. Who've never looked at me or anything. It's Dee Snider's son. I don't like Dee Snider. You know, the people who engage with me for more than a minute usually see that I'm a pretty altruistic guy. And, you know, I make art to try to make the world a better place the way I know how.
Could you talk a little bit about when you were a graphic novel writer in Dead Romeo?
Yeah, I still am, although I've gone independent. I'm working on an anthology magazine like Heavy Metal, which is going to be articles on the craft, articles on the best stuff that nobody knows about, and really high-level comic books, photos, and poems, and things like that, called Blacklight District Magazine, which is based on my Blacklight District comic book that came out through Image Comics that has music and comics combined. We've got that online at www.blacklightdistrict.co, and you can check it out for free. I've always been a huge comic book fan for a long time, and Savage Dragon was the book that really keyed me into comics, and I read that monthly for an age. And I eventually got into Deadpool and then a larger love of Marvel Comics. And then from there, I had a friend get me into DC, and before you knew it, I was reading like 100 and something plus comic books every month. And because I was a writer, I was looking for what I was going to do to contribute to the world of writing. And they say, you know, write what you read. And all of a sudden it dawned on me, I'm like, I should write comic books, I guess. And I started to pursue writing comic books in a big way. I wrote for Marvel. And then eventually, because Marvel had their eye on me, I was able to hook up with Dan DiDio, who gave me my first work at DC, creating this vampire romance comic book for them called Dead Romeo, which I created the whole concept and everything for them. Although I wish my original concept would have been good. You know, Dead Romeo was cool. I mean, everything that I did in the corporate world was just sort of a disappointment to me in so many ways. I loved the mythology of comic books so much, and I wanted to go in and be a part of the architecture. You know, there's this wonderful thing in comic books that doesn't happen in the real world, but should, where one creator comes in and creates a concept, and the next creator comes in and makes it better. And then the next guy comes in and he makes it better and better and better. And occasionally you get some bad guys in there who make it worse. But largely, you get just a continual stream of beautiful, creative people perpetually making the world and the characters richer and better and better. And with DC, you know, like few of these things have been able to come up onto the big screen because they've been, they just do not honor the source material at all, except in the animated universe where they've done a good job with that for many years. But, you know, Marvel's very good at doing this. And I really wanted to be a part of that. I wanted to be a part of honoring this source material and creating new toys, putting new toys in the toy box for Marvel and DC. My frustration with not being able to do that to the degree that I wanted to eventually just sort of bubbled over into frustration with how the projects that I did work on, even, you know, for licensed things for Disney, for the Muppets, and like everything I worked on was not as great as it could have been. You know, my Muppets thing was one of my most disappointing things I ever did. This is my son, Grayson. I'm doing an interview, buddy. Hello. I love you. But the Muppet thing was one of the most disappointing things I ever did because it was the greatest scripts I'd ever turned in. I knew I'm the biggest Muppet fan in the world, and I knew it was the greatest piece of Muppet material that had been written since a while, since Muppet Fairy Tales, Muppet Classic Theater, which was a really great thing with Rizzo and Gonzo hosting a bunch of fairy tales. It was really true to Henson's vision, and I nailed it. And when I handed it into them, I wrote the first, second, and third issue in a week. And then on the last day, I got my notes back for issue one, and I was so heartbroken because it was so obvious to me that the people who were in control of the license, they didn't get the Muppets, and they ruined my book as far as I'm concerned. I mean, people still really like it, and it's considered one of the best Muppet things to come out of there, which I guess it could be considering the terrible notes that I got on my material, notes that made it worse, so much worse. I could not believe it. They wanted me to add a joke to every panel. I was like, a joke to every panel? You have no idea what reading a comic book is like. Parents are not going to be able to read this to their children. This, you can't have a joke in every panel. This whole book is going to drag. It's got to be, it's got to have a light tone to it. They softened my really sweet moments and made them goofy and not meaningful. And they took out some of my biting moments and made them numb. And, you know, so they neutralized so much of its dynamic, and it was awful. And by the time I finished this, I was so grateful to be writing the Muppets. And then they just like, they raped my script. And I was just like, I can't keep doing this to myself. I can't keep loving these things so much and having them destroyed by people who don't love these things as much as I love them to know any better than destroy them. And, you know, from there, I decided to be an independent publisher. So, you know, I've worked with the Four Horsemen Studios on their Mythic Legions comic for their action figure line. You know, love those guys. I love toys. And I produced the Blacklight District 6 issues music comic book. And now I've been working on this anthology project and producing different comic book stories for that, and working on articles now to complete the process.
We have a portion of the show, and we call it the TRQ. It stands for Totally Random Questions. So, Jesse, are you ready for the TRQ?
Totally, totally, totally random questions. Totally, totally, totally random questions.
Bring it on.
He's ready, folks. He's ready. Being that we were talking about animation and cartoons, and you've got kids who've paid us a little visit, during the course of the interview. That's okay. Were there cartoons that your kids watch that you just can't stand, that make you crazy?
I love the cartoons that they watch. I kind of hate the YouTube channels that they watch. Oh, some of these YouTube channels are just like, ugh. It just goes to show how consistency goes a long way. You don't really have to be particularly good at something, but if you just keep showing up doing a similar thing that people kind of like, then that's it. And, you know, kids are undiscerning viewers so often. So, oh, my God, I get so many things on all the time that just, like, I want to kill myself. And just, especially people playing video games. I really feel like I must be an old person. I'm like, I just don't get it. I don't get watching other people play video games. Just like I don't get watching people play football. I want to play football. I watch and I'm like, I just want to get in the game. I want to get in the game. I'm a football player. I want to play football. I'm a video game player. I want to play video game. So, like, that drives me a little crazy, some of those things. And especially just because, I don't know, I guess there's a part of me that's like, it doesn't seem fair. All these kids, they're being, like, spoiled like crazy by their parents in ways that I either don't wish to spoil them or can't spoil them. And I'm just like, what are you doing to yourselves? Like, this is torture. You really want to watch a bunch of people who are just opening presents all day long? Like, it just kind of like, upsets me. But I don't know. They love that stuff. So, but the cartoons, no, I'm cool. I just finished Star Wars Clone Wars. I'm on to Star Wars Rebels. And I like so many of the cartoons that they watch. There's a bunch of things on Netflix that are very similar to old school Warner Brothers cartoons. A lot of visual comedy, physical comedy. And I quite enjoy a lot of those shows.
Say you were doing an album and you were going to do a duet with someone. Who would be your unlikely duet partner?
My unlikely duet partner. I don't know, maybe the chick from the Cranberries. I really never liked that damn zombie song. I know people love it, but I just feel like she's singing like a goat. Zombie. Yeah, so she probably would not be my first choice.
Okay, well, she died, so I don't think you have to worry about her.
She died? Yeah. Great, I'm disrespecting a dead person. I'm sorry, singer from the Cranberries. I didn't really mean it.
Now she's going to come back with the Hollywood Vampires.
Great. I'm cursed now.
Being a Long Islander, do you have a favorite beach?
Jones Beach is probably the one that, you know, I have the most fond memories of, you know, just my mom saying, we're going to go to Jones Beach. And so a lot of resonance in that one for me. But I've come to like a lot of them because we've started a lot of the March of Dimes, Bikers for Babies runs at the different beaches and stuff. At this point, I've hung out all over the island, all over the beaches. I'm always happy somewhere on the beach on Long Island.
What was the best advice that you ever got from your parents, and what's the best advice that you give your kids?
Best advice I ever got from my parents was when I was asking if I should change my name to Super. I thought that was kind of a cool punk rock name. And I was thinking I might just get the Superman logo tattooed on my chest in red and call myself Super. I was really young. And I didn't like my name. And my mom and my dad essentially said the same thing to me. They were like, well, if you believe in that, then that's cool. You know, if you believe it's cool, then it's cool. And if you don't believe that your name is cool, then it's not. That is really the truth. But when I really started to process that over time, I realized that the smart thing to do was to change my mind about how I felt about my name, because that was my name. And that all I had to do was think that Jesse Blaze was cool, which is my legal name, Jesse Blaze, and Jesse Blaze Snyder. But you know, trying to at least do it on my own name, and coming to grips with that, like liking my name and valuing, you know, what it meant. And you know, Jesse means sun god, and it's kind of cool. And Jesse James has, you know, cowboy aesthetics, Western aesthetics, and Johnny Blaze is the Ghost Rider that has, you know, magical aesthetic and redemption aesthetic and so many things. So you know, taking my name and taking ownership of it in a good way, that taught me that, you know, I had to do that because you have to believe in the thing. You got to go out into the world and be Jesse. You got to go out to the world and sell your music. And if you don't believe in it, the other people won't believe in it either. So that was probably the best advice I ever got from them. I mean, the best advice I ever gave my kids, I really just gave them yesterday. It was that they deserve everything. They deserve heaven on earth. They deserve the best life imaginable, and that they shouldn't for one second think that they have to struggle or be in any sort of pain to get it, that the next generation, and it can get easier, and it can get easier, and we will still learn the lessons that we need to know, even though we're billionaires. There are tons of shitty billionaires in the world, and I'm sure they're still learning the things that they need to learn as they grow in their life. Whatever you want, you can have, you deserve it. Everybody does. Accept that everybody does, even Hitler. You know, God will sort them out, not you. It's your job to love everybody and to love yourself and to give yourself permission to have and do whatever is in your heart to have and whatever is in your heart to do. And, you know, the piece of advice that was best prior to this one was just that I trusted their heart and I believed that they knew what was right for them and that I would always try to allow them to honor their own heart in their lives and never try to make them into somebody that they are not.
And that's actually a great segue into a little sub question. You were inspired to write a song for your daughter's christening.
Go with me. You know, the wonderful thing about that was like that was like a test for me of ego, because I really had sort of insecurity like in my songwriting. I wanted to prove that I was a great songwriter. I believed that that was my ability that I had. And Baptized by Fire, we were such a heavy band that a lot of people couldn't always appreciate the songwriting that was on display within my songs because it was so heavy. And I was looking for a song for the christening. I was trying to write one. I was trying to write the perfect song that was, you know, what I wanted to say, and I was struggling with it. And my manager at the time sent me a song, an unfinished song from a friend of hers that came to mind. And I think it might have been called something else or slightly different than Go With Me. But when I heard it, it filled me up. It was exactly what I wanted to say. And it's actually one of the few songs in my catalog that didn't really start with me. And I did some writing on it. I think I wrote the bridge and rewrote a couple melodies and a few lyrics within it as I tweaked it for myself. But it is a gift from the heavens from Johnny Black, who is a brilliant songwriter in his own right. And he had written this song and it was just kind of sitting around not doing anything. And when I heard it, I fell in love with it. It was so beautiful. And I was so grateful that it got brought to my attention, because in the moment, I wasn't finding what I was looking for from my own writing. And that just spoke volumes to me. And it's become a song that's so meaningful for so many people. You know, played at weddings and christenings and so many other things. And I get messages about it all the time. It's really nice.
Well, I wasn't aware of it till recently. And I was like, wow, this is unbelievable. And it's so different from your style, as your usual style, like you said.
Yeah, you know. And for me, too, I love when I can do something like that, some of the melody stuff originated from another, brilliant writer, because I learned from them just having to go into the studio and record and write some melodies in some places that I wasn't, you know, always writing melodies, or places I was a little less comfortable. It definitely grew me as a writer. And now I think you hear all sorts of Go With Me sort of things within so much of the stuff that I do. And it came from some great influence and collaboration with Johnny Black, who's a very talented songwriter in and of himself.
Okay, I got one last question. As an MTV VJ, did you ever have a favorite music video, or after a while you just kind of didn't pay attention to them?
Oh yeah. Not because of I was an MTV2 VJ. I mean, those videos didn't really ever speak to me. I mean, some of the songs did, but the videos sucked. But the videos from the 80s, oh man, so many favorite videos, because my mom used to just have the MTV on all day long, because Dad might show up on the TV, and it would be like, Daddy's on, wee! And we'd celebrate. You know, I was just a little kid, so, you know, I'm a baby. I'm like, hey, it's my daddy, woo! And there was all these songs all the time. And I remember being viscerally affected by Fight for Your Right to Party by the Beastie Boys. And I thought they were giants. When I eventually saw a picture of them in my teen years, I'm like, they're so skinny. I thought they were really big. But I was like, two. The Beastie Boys. They're called the Beastie Boys. And they're big. Like, you know, but they weren't big. Maybe it's the Genesis song where they had all like the claymation heads. Land of Confusion, that's the one. This is the world. Land of Confusion, yeah, there it is.
Okay.
Yeah, that one. That one, Land of Confusion, and Fight for Right to Party. Those two, other than Twisted Sister videos, because I know those really well. You Can't Stop Rock and Roll is one of my favorite songs of all time. My favorite Twisted Sister video.
Let's remind everybody again the name of the album.
It's called Come With Me If You Want to Live. Just type in Jesse Blaze, and you will find that and more.
If I could call on your DJ skills one more time and to lead us out of here, if you can introduce Promised Land.
Hey, this is Jesse Blaze Snyder, and you're listening to Promised Land from my new album, Come With Me If You Want to Live, available on all platforms. Check it out.
Jesse Blaze Snyder, thanks so much for coming by.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm going to go play with my kids.
Thanks again so much to Jesse Blaze Snyder for swinging down by the Sherpa Chalet. And be sure to check out his new album, Come With Me If You Want to Live. It really rocks. And I've included a link on the show notes on the Sherpa sheet. You know those. And you can listen to all of his music. And it's definitely worth checking out. And I'm really happy that I got to do this because for a while, I couldn't really find any good rock music. And then Jesse came along and boom, there it is. This is what we've been looking for. So I hope you enjoy it as much as I enjoyed his music and him coming down for the interview. You can follow this show on social media. Just use the word Sherpalution for Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And you can hear the show on your favorite podcast app or my website, Sherpalution.com. Don't forget, please leave me a nice review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or iHeartRadio. And spread the word about the Sherpalution. Speaking of another guy who knows how to rock, Mr. Bruce, I'll give you your air guitar back if you would show everybody the door. See you next time, everybody.
Thanks for listening to Too Many Podcasts. Please disperse. You can go home now. I said you can go home now. Viva la Sherpalution. Viva la Sherpalition.
Yell, come back now, you hear?